Thanks so much for joining us today on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and today we explore the Mississippi River, the geological, the cultural, the natural history of the river, and what you can see and do along it. And we have a great guide for you, Dean Klinkenberg. He is the author of the new book, The Wild Mississippi, a state-by-state guide to the river's natural wonders. Dean was an academic psychologist before becoming an author of guidebooks and mystery novels, and it's great to have him with us today. So as we talk about the Mississippi, I hope you'll join in. Have you visited many places along the Mississippi River? What's your favorite? Where would you like to go next? Questions about the river or its history? I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Dean Klinkenberg, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, Larry, thanks so much for having me on. I'm really looking forward to talking about my favorite subject.
Well, I tell you what, you've written a dandy book here. One of the things I really liked about the book was you spend a fair amount of time in the beginning, the first chapters, dealing with the kind of the history and what has made the Mississippi River the kind of the way it is. And I'm sure you were very purposeful about that, because I think it gives us some background before we actually get into visiting along the place.
Yeah, absolutely. I was surprised as I got into this, learning how much we do know, and then also how much we don't know about the river's geologic past. There was a study maybe 3 or 4 years ago that suggested the river's been around for 70 million years, and that just kind of blew my mind.
And it's a lot smaller, I guess, today than it was. It carried 8 times as much water at one point.
Yeah, I think this is one of the things that it's hard for us to sometimes understand how dynamic the river can be. And at different points in time, the river has been much bigger. It's been much smaller. Of course, it's changed its channel a few times here and there, depending upon what was going on. Sometimes ice pushed it an entirely new channel. So the river has been through a lot of changes in its 70 million history, as one would hope.
Yeah, as for sure. And as I understand it, the river is expected to grow bigger once again.
Yeah, I mean, there's a combination of a couple different factors at play here, but the short version of this is, you know, when the glaciers cover land, the land sinks, and then as the glaciers retreat, the land rises back up. And the land, especially in Canada, is still rising in response to the glaciers leaving, and that's probably going to change the size of the Mississippi's watershed and force more water into the Mississippi Valley. We're not going to be around to see much of an effect of that, but we are seeing precipitation changes, especially up in your part of the river, where you've had a lot of rain again this spring. Precipitation trends are up, particularly in the upper half of the river, but along much of it, which is making the river bigger again as well.
So we're going to talk a little more about the history. The European impact on Native Americans was obviously great. The displacement of many indigenous peoples. And that reshaped the settlement of the Mississippi.
Yeah, it's hard to get a handle on exactly how many different indigenous tribes or communities lived along the river, but we know indigenous people lived along the Mississippi for probably at least 13,000 years down on the lower part of the river, and probably at least 12,000 on the upper part of the river. Lots of communities, close ties to the river, dependent upon the river for their sustenance. And then as Europeans came in and forced those indigenous communities out, it sort of changed the nature of the relationship we have, that humans have with the Mississippi, and it changed the lives and lifestyles of the indigenous people that used to live here.
Yeah. I was interested in some of the things that happened. Steamboats. The introduction of steamboats on the river before the Civil War and the effect it had on the area. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, if you think about like the difference in transportation time from something as simple as like driving to New York versus flying to New York, before steamboats, people basically, they could travel downriver, but they were at the mercy of the current, and then they either had this laborious prospect of pulling a boat upriver essentially from there, or walking back, or horseback riding along the river. It could take weeks to travel along the river. And a steamboat, you could do that same trip in a matter of days. So it made the world a lot smaller. And we've seen some changes like that in our world, I think, with how communication has made the world feel smaller as well. But this really transformed and opened up parts of the country to new settlements and that previously were difficult to get to and supply.
Yeah, and then of course railroads came along and kind of replaced the steamboats.
Pretty much. They pretty much rendered steamboats and a lot of river transportation irrelevant.
At one point, you write, which I thought was a really interesting way to put it, you write that we have tamed the Mississippi River not as well as a domesticated dog, but more like a wolf cub raised by humans.
Yeah, I think we have this illusion that we've kind of controlled the river, but really that river is pretty sneaky, and a lot of the structures that we've built, they have assumptions about what kind of river we're trying to control. And as you know, as we said earlier, the river is already changing and growing some, and there's some questions about how well these structures might hold up to increasing amounts of water that are almost inevitably coming our way.
Yeah. How much of the river have you paddled? Have you paddled quite a bit of it?
I've done small segments. I know I have friends who've paddled the whole river. Probably my favorite trip is a few years ago. I got to paddle with a group in a big canoe from New Orleans to the Gulf of Mexico and camp our last night on a barrier island. That was one of my favorite trips of all time. I'm trying to get more miles in canoes and kayaks, but it takes me a little while.
Well, you know, the river's tame in spots. I think it's kind of wild in spots. In your mind, where is the river the wildest?
Surprisingly, I think some of the wildest parts of the river are the lower Mississippi. When I before I did any, I've had the good luck of going on some canoe trips on the lower Mississippi, besides that one to the Gulf. And my preconception before that first trip was that the area between the levees down there was going to be kind of sterile and uninteresting. And I got in a canoe and we got going, and I was surprised at how remote it felt, how much life really did thrive in those areas. In some places, the space between the levees is pretty narrow, and in others, it's not. But there are islands full of beavers and muskrats and lots of birds and turtles. And you can go, I think the longest stretch is 60 or 70 miles between bridges. And there are very few communities along the river down there. So it feels pretty remote when you're on a boat traveling down that part of the river.
You mentioned the narrowness at one point at least, but it's wide in some points. What's the widest part of the river, of the river?
Yeah, I like to joke that that's a good way to start an argument among river rats, is asking where the widest part of the river is. Yes, I think if you're looking at below the Twin Cities, the pool at Fulton and Clinton, that area is technically the widest right now, where the water stays. It's like 2.5-ish miles, I think, wide at that point. Lake Pepin is the widest natural segment of the river below the Twin Cities. But up north, the Mississippi passes through Lake Winnie, which is what, 11 miles wide? So I guess it depends on which lake you want to count, but I like to say it's Lake Winnie.
Oh man, how much sediment moves down the river?
Well, not as much as they're used to. So, obviously that muddy color we associate with the Mississippi is from sediment. It's not from pollution. A lot of people think that it's, something that's we should avoid and terrible, but it's just dirt. It's just sediment the river carries. The dams on the Missouri River have blocked a lot of the sediment that flowed down the Missouri River. And really, the Missouri historically contributed the bulk of the sediment to the lower Mississippi. The upper Mississippi used to run pretty clear when you read the stories from travelers who were along the river a couple hundred years ago. They lauded how beautiful the clear water was of the upper Mississippi. But modern agriculture has dumped more sediment into the Mississippi than it used to, and the upper part of the river, And now the navigation dams trap a lot of that sediment behind those dams.
Yeah. And I'm just, how is the channelization, the building of levees and dams, it's had a big, huge impact on, I think, everything, but including wildlife. And I wondered about wildlife.
Yeah, but the channelization is problematic more, I think, in certain segments than in other. Like right now, we're celebrating the 100th birthday of the Upper Mississippi Refuge. And there, channelization has been a little bit less of an issue. You still have connections between a lot of the river's historic habitats and ecosystems. But you go south of the Quad Cities, and the river's not really connected to many wetlands anymore. So there's a lot of, there's some loss of species and abundance along that part of the river because there's just nothing to support that kind of life. And the channelization is kind of, you know, in my part of the river especially, like the Mississippi is almost acting like a small stream sometimes. Like the river is more subject to dramatic rises and falls than it was historically because of the channelization of the river.
Yeah, it's amazing. Are there any rapids on the Mississippi?
There are, mostly up north. Yeah, there's a series of small rapids through northern Minnesota, like Pakegama Falls around Grand Rapids is one of the better known stretches. There was also a stretch of rapids around the Quad Cities and around Keokuk. Those are now submerged by the navigation dams. And out down here in my area, the Chain of Rocks was an area of rapids as well.
Well, you go through a nice history, and we've really given a thumbnail sketch of it, but maybe talk about the book itself, aside from this history and background and learning about the river, then we get into places that we can go and see.
Yeah, so the model in my head for this book was kind of like a city guide. Like if you bought a guidebook for Paris, it would give you some history of Paris, and it would give you a description of the neighborhoods of the city, and it would give you some highlights of things to see and do. But it wouldn't tell you about every single building in Paris. And I think this book kind of follows that model. So the first half of the book really peels back the layers in the river's world. So there are chapters on main channel and, you know, what kind of life lives in and depends on flowing water. Wetlands, forests, and grasslands are also additional chapters. So the book kind of describes in pretty general terms what those habitats and ecosystems are like and what kind of life they generally support. And then the second half of the book is a state-by-state listing for all 10 states that touch the main channel of the Mississippi, listing public lands where people can go to have experiences that experience different parts of the river's world. I wanted there to be some range in the experiences. So there are places of wetlands, there are places with grasslands, places you can just have a nice view of the river. And all of them are easy to get to.
Yeah. Our guest today, it's great to have him with us to talk about the Mississippi River and what's going on and what we can all see there. Dean Klinkenberg is our author today for this first segment of our show, and his book is titled The Wild Mississippi, A State-by-State Guide to the River's Natural Wonders. Questions, comments, maybe some experiences you've had along the river? I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking with Dean Klinkenberg, who has written The Wild Mississippi, A State-by-State Guide to the River's Natural Wonders. Great to have him with us. And again, you can join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can email to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Cheryl in Clark County has called to say that they've read the book and enjoyed it very much, Dean. She's curious to know how much is known about the indigenous people who built the mounds and why they built the mounds.
Yeah, boy, I would say there's speculation, but it's hard to know for sure some of the why. Mound building has a long history in North America. I think the earliest mounds that we know of were built in southern Louisiana or in Louisiana at a place called Watson Break over 5,000 years ago. And that mound building culture then kind of spread along the Mississippi. There's speculation that, you know, some of the mounds were for burials, but many of them were for symbolic reasons. And I'm certainly not an expert in indigenous spiritual views, but my understanding is that a lot of the times they would choose the tops of bluffs near rivers as a way to sort of get closer to the upper world that they believed was part of their cosmological system. So it was a way to connect the world where people lived with the upper world where some of the other spiritual beings lived. But there are, I'm sure there are lots of other things about the mound building we'll never fully understand.
Yeah. Cahokia in Illinois, I think it's east of St. Louis, that Cahokia Mounds historic site, very significant site.
Yeah, and I don't know if you've ever been there yourself, you've had a chance to travel down here. It's one of those sites, I think, to myself, if they had built with stone instead of dirt, it would be as famous as Machu Picchu or the pyramids of Egypt. It was a remarkable city that was built over 1,000 years ago, and most of it seemed to have been built practically overnight in one big burst of construction. Archaeologist Timothy, I'm going to butcher his name, Pocketuck, calls the Cahokia Big Bang. So this happened very rapidly, and the city had tens of thousands of people living in the main city and in surrounding villages during its peak. Very complex cultural systems. So I think it's, you know, at the time it was bigger than London. It's just, it was a remarkable place, and it's remarkable to me how much we do know about it. But there's still a lot of questions about what happened to it ultimately and what day-to-day life was like.
Yeah, absolutely. Barbara in Cross Plains has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Barbara.
I'm so excited you're on today because a week ago we discovered the city park in Lansing when we went over the bridge that's just recently been reopened, crossing from Wisconsin over to Lansing. And there is a city park there with two overlooks, one higher than the other. And you look down on the Mississippi going in both directions. And I always thought Wyalusing's outlook from the confluence of the Mississippi and Wisconsin was the best. Well, this might almost beat it. And I can't believe that'll happen, not in Wisconsin. But it's Mount Hosner Park. And outside of town is a wonderful interpretive center with all kinds of really basic, easy to understand information about the Mississippi, the traffic, the barges. I'm very excited about this new find.
Barbara, thanks a lot for calling. Comment, Dean.
She's right. That's a spectacular view from there. I've made it one of my missions to try to get on top of every bluff that's publicly accessible as I can to try to see where the best views are. And Mount Hosmer and Lansing certainly is among the best. I'd be hard pressed to choose which one is actually best, but Great River Bluff State Park has magnificent views. Buena Vista Park in Alma, Wisconsin, also spectacular views from up there. So I think people should just make it a mission to collect all those bluff top overlooks, and then we can all discuss which ones they like best.
Lansing, Iowa. Well, what about, in fact, in your book, you mentioned Pikes Peak State Park near McGregor, Iowa. Talk about that.
One of the things I like about that, it's a very popular spot to stop for the overlook, and I think for good reason, because part of the reason that it's so spectacular there is you're looking directly at the confluence of the Wisconsin and Mississippi rivers. So this nice complex of islands and back channels that you can see from up there. The park itself is really beautiful too, and there's some nice hiking trails that most people never explore, but the overlook really is beautiful. I've been there all times of year, and I find it spectacular even in the middle of winter.
Yeah, and as long as we're talking about Iowa, and I kind of wanted to zero in on the places we can drive in a day and in sort of the Midwest states that are along the river. And another thing you mentioned is the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium. That's located in Dubuque, Iowa.
Yeah, boy, it's just one of the best museums about the river that I think you'll ever find. They have aquariums with fish, native fish and wildlife, so you can see what a blue catfish looks like. They're gigantic. There are tanks with turtles and other, amphibians and reptiles. And then they have aquariums also that showcase the life at the end of the river support, so more of these coastal habitats. So there's tanks with fish that thrive in those coastal habitats. Plus, there are lots of exhibits on our history with the river, indigenous history, navigation. It's really a spectacular place. There's a reason there's a Smithsonian affiliate. It's because they just do everything so well.
Let's go back up. Let's go further north from Iowa to neighboring Minnesota and some of the places along the path of the Mississippi River that might be worth visiting. Of course, the headwaters are at Itasca State Park, are they not?
They are. So that's Itasca State Park is absolutely one of my favorite spots to go. It's a little bit of a drive for me from St. Louis. It wouldn't be quite so bad from Wisconsin. But it's another one of these places where I think you can, in some places, you can kind of step back in time. There are patches of old growth pine forest intact in Itasca State Forest or Itasca State Park. I really like hiking through those areas to get a sense of what those old forests might have felt like to walk through. But the park has, you know, a fantastic lodge to stay at and cabins, a big campground, and then you can paddle on Lake Itasca itself. And maybe if you're lucky, you'll be there in a day when some long-distance paddler is putting in a kayak on their way down to the Gulf of Mexico.
That'd be pretty cool. And you can walk from bank to bank there at some point.
You can, and you're probably not going to get your knees wet unless you're a child. So.
And the elevation, that interested me. It's, I think you point out, it's 1,475 feet above sea level. And then, of course, it takes a pretty good drop as it goes down.
Yeah, the river drops more than half of its elevation toward the Gulf of Mexico just within Minnesota. it flattens out quite a bit after that.
Oh, man, that's amazing to me. Well, the Mississippi National River and Recreation Area, it runs, I think it's 72 miles, and runs through the Twin Cities. How well protected is that section of the river?
I think it's a bit of a mixed bag. I think a lot of it is fairly well protected. There's a lot of public land right next to the river that both Minneapolis and St. Paul made an effort to protect long ago. In the suburbs, some of the land, there's a lot more private land that's a little harder for the National Refuge or Recreation Area to manage. But it's still like there are really fantastic places you can get near the river or on the river in that 72-mile stretch. And I think people in the Twin Cities are pretty well aware of how special that is and do spend a fair amount of time out on there. Living in St. Louis, where our riverfront is highly industrial and dominated by the navigation industry, every time I go up to the Twin Cities, I'm envious of how easy they have access to the river and how easy it is to get on there.
Yeah, and I think you particularly cite Minneapolis as just a beautiful place to, because you can go right down to the water's edge.
Yeah, and the river changes a lot just within the borders of Minneapolis. So the only gorge in the whole path of the Mississippi goes through Minneapolis. So there's really big changes you can see. And when the river enters the Twin Cities, it's kind of a small prairie river in some ways, a little slow and not real deep. And then it passes through the gorge, and then eventually it makes a sharp turn into St. Paul and then turns south into the beautiful Valley of the Driftless area that probably most folks are familiar with.
Joel Patnaud, our producer for this show, wanted to point out the Kiona County State Recreation Area. It's a former iron ore mining site, now a popular place for mountain biking, as I understand it.
Yeah, I mean, part of the reason I wanted to include that in the book, it's centered around Crosby, Minnesota. So a couple of hours, maybe 2.5 hours away from the Twin Cities, depending upon where you're starting. It's an area where they had open pit mines that closed a long time ago, and nature sort of overtook or retook that place back. So you have some of the open pit mines are now deep lakes, and the hills that were the scraps from the mining era are now growing trees and other vegetation. So it's become a very popular place for mountain biking. Or just to kind of go to get away for a weekend. There's a lot of recreation opportunities there.
Yeah. Roger in Grantsburg, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Roger.
Hey, Larry, how are you doing today?
Great, appreciate the call.
I was just wondering if your host or your guest, I live up in Grantsburg by the St. Croix. I'm only about 10 miles from the St. Croix River. And I wonder if you'd spend any time on that. That's a tributary of the Mississippi, flows in at Prescott, Wisconsin. And I wonder if you've ever spent any time up there.
Yeah.
I have. I've spent some time on the lower St. Croix, more around like Hudson and then down to Prescott in that area. And it's really beautiful there. It's got some similarities geologically, I think, to the Mississippi. Some of that part of the St. Croix was also essentially carved by glacial meltwaters a few thousand years ago. So you have the valley that looks pretty similar, but it's a beautiful spot, and I probably ought to spend more time in a canoe up there.
As I was going back to your book and looking at you, you have some really cool photos of the major tributaries of the Mississippi, which are really cool shots.
Thanks. I got lucky a couple of years ago where I got to be a host to talk with a couple of politicians who were flying over the Mississippi from St. Louis down to Cairo, where the Ohio River meets the Mississippi. And I got to take a lot of pictures from there. So I got a really nice picture of the Ohio River from that plane.
Yeah, you did indeed. Roger, thanks again. Appreciate it. Jim in Newport Township, Illinois. Hi, Jim.
Yes, hello. According to knowledge I've been exposed to, at the confluence of the upper Mississippi with the Missouri, on average, about 70% of the flow is actually coming from the Missouri River. So, I mean, some people argue that it's not to take away that there are many wondrous things about the upper Mississippi, but it's like the Mississippi is flowing into the Missouri River rather than the way we accept it.
Then the other way around. Okay, well, what do you think, Dean?
It's funny. This is the second best way to start an argument among river rats is to ask which name should carry south from there. I have an entire presentation I put together just on this issue. So I'll give you the short version of it is really like historically, the Missouri and the upper Mississippi carried a fairly similar amount of water. It's a little hard to judge today because the flow of the upper Missouri of the Missouri River is managed by the dams on the upper part of the Missouri. So it's not a natural flow anymore. It is managed. But historically, you know, the Missouri would come up at a certain time of the year and then fall back. But if you average the volume over time, the two rivers were pretty similar. The Missouri is longer, so that's, you know, some people point to that. I like to think it's the Mississippi that's the river that's going north to south, and the Missouri is crashing into it. So, you know, seems like the Mississippi ought to be, you know, for that reason and others, maybe that's the name that should be carrying forward.
Oh boy, Jim, thanks a lot. And water, I mean, water. You write in the book that water across 1.25 million acres flows into the river.
It is a very big watershed. I think it's the third or fourth largest watershed in the world. And what's really crazy when you think about that is how concentrated all that water becomes further south. So by the time you get around like Vicksburg and Natchez and that part, all of that water, all these big rivers have fed into the Mississippi, and it's all in this one channel as it passes by Vicksburg, Baton Rouge, New Orleans. Now, there's some that's ciphered off above Baton Rouge, but that's an awful lot of water from a continent being funneled into one narrow channel.
It is indeed. Janie in Sugar Creek, Wisconsin, it's your turn. Hi, Janie.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I heard you talking about overlooks on the Mississippi, and I thought of my home area, which is Burlington, Iowa, and there is a property on a bluff above, or actually below, if you're talking river, below Burlington, and it's on Clay Street off of South Main, and it is the Leopold Dankward property, and that's where our beloved Aldo Leopold grew up.
Ah, there you go.
That's right. Yeah, I didn't know that until I started doing some research, more research about Burlington a few years ago, Aldo Leopold's hometown. Almost certainly his childhood growing up near the Mississippi had some effect on his view of the natural world. And Burlington has its own big river history and some great places to see and experience the river. There's a pretty good culture of having cabins on islands in the Mississippi there, from what I understand. I got to visit one a few years ago and ride out there in a John boat and enjoy a couple of beers with somebody I just met as we watched the river flow. So kind of like a universal river activity.
Janie, thanks a lot for calling. I did not know that Burlington, Iowa is the childhood home of Aldo Leopold. So there you go. You can join in too, by the way. I'm getting some great calls. What about experiences or things to share about the river? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. I want to turn our attention a bit to Wisconsin, because in the book, I went and counted, you had 14 parks and wilderness and wildlife areas along the Mississippi on the Wisconsin side. That's got to be thousands of acres.
Yeah, and I had to leave some places out. So, yeah, Minnesota, Wisconsin especially, are blessed with a lot of public lands, and it made it difficult for me to figure out which ones to include and which ones to leave out. But part of it is, it is a lot of acres and it's growing. There are some organizations that are still buying private property along the river to preserve for future generations. So I wanted to make sure to include places that had a good mix of ecosystems and opportunities. So, you know, I ended up leaving out some really nice places just because I kind of duplicated something else. But I hope people will use this as a starting point. These, you know, the 14 places in Wisconsin, I think are really exceptional places and have a lot to offer. But there are a lot of other places I hope they'll also just take some time to explore, like the state natural areas. Like, I think everybody probably is familiar with the state parks and probably the wildlife refuges, but there are a lot of properties that are state natural areas that aren't as managed and don't have the number of visitors as the state parks and refuges tend to. They can be quieter places to visit.
Yeah, they can indeed. And, you know, this, just back in history just a bit there, in 1924, I believe, the Upper Mississippi River National Wildlife and Fish Refuge, you point out, was established. It was really interesting because there was a group of women who were important in getting this established.
Yeah, it took a coalition of people to really pull that off. And Will Dilg gets a lot of credit as the main person pushing and lobbying for this refuge, but he was one of the co-founders of the Isaac Walton League. But they could not have done it without the support of women's groups, without the support of other conservationists and some hunters. That what they did is they managed to get this refuge established essentially in one congressional session, which you think about how hard it is to get anything done today. And they did this in a few months, essentially. This something that had never, you know, they passed this legislation creating this refuge that had never been done on that scale before in this country. So we're still benefiting from that.
Yeah, I was thinking about the upper, the refuge in the, and they're different districts. So like the Winona district, for example, there's a dandy refuge right there.
Absolutely. I have a podcast about the Mississippi, and the last episode I released, I got to talk with the refuge manager and the visitor services coordinator from the Upper Miss Refuge. And there are so many fantastic places within the refuge itself. And I think part of the problem they struggle with is, you know, it's not like a state park and that there are real clear boundaries. Like, you know, when you're in the state park, because, well, in Minnesota, Wisconsin, you got to pay a fee to go in for one thing or have a sticker. But for the refuge, you can just wander in and you may not realize that you're in territory that's part of this national refuge. So they're doing their part to make it easy, you know, make it more obvious which parts of the refuge, but there's some beautiful spots.
And along Wisconsin, what do we got? We got 230 miles of, you look at, as you say, bluffs, thick forest, and wetlands.
Yeah, so pick a spot. Like, you can't really lose, you know, with all that.
Oh, man. Bob in Cottage in Barnes, Wisconsin.
Hello, Larry.
Hi, Bob.
That was quick.
Well, how are things in Barnes?
Oh, it's beautiful, sunny, and about 68 degrees and wonderful and no bugs.
That's good to hear. We've got a cabin in Barnes area. So, well, what's your question or comment?
Well, my comment was that years ago we took houseboat rides up to from La Crosse to Winona and had a wonderful time. And then Bemidji, Minnesota was supposedly the start of the Mississippi River. Is that right?
Well, it's close. Bemidji's slogan is the first city on the Mississippi, but the river actually starts a bit downriver, like 60 miles at Itasca State Park.
But it's the first city.
Yes. And they make a big deal about that.
Oh, Bob, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Dean Klinkenberg, our guest today, we're talking about his new book, Outstanding. It's called The Wild Mississippi, A State-by-State Guide to the River's Natural Wonders. You can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or shoot an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking with Dean Klinkenberg, who has written The Wild Mississippi, A State-by-State Guide to the River's Natural Wonders. Great to have him with us. And again, you can join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can email to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Therese emailed to say they visited Wyalusing State Park many times, loves the view from campsites up on the cliff, and while paddling on the Mississippi River there, they've seen water snakes, a ton of fish. It's surprisingly calm and fascinating area. And Teresa added that the entire Driftless area has great rivers.
Oh, yeah, I'm not going to argue with that. So I love Wyalusing State Park as well. One of the things that's spectacular, and I'm not giving any secrets away with this. I think if you live in the area, you know this already, but there are a string of campground or campsites that are right on the edge of the bluff at Wyalusing State Park. And I've been lucky enough to camp there a handful of times. They go fast, especially on weekends. But it's really, the views are like million-dollar views, and you're just paying for a campsite. So I think that's, you know, it's a great opportunity for just about anybody to be able to enjoy those spectacular views. But the park has a paddle trail, you know, canoe trail that takes you through the backwaters, and it has hiking trails along the bluff and down to the floodplain forest. But this is kind of typical, as she was saying, for places along the Driftless area. There are lots of parks and nature areas and private places that you might be able to access that also have the same amenities. So it's we're very lucky to have access to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you, in the book, you write that you really love the Trempealeau National Wildlife Refuge. Talk about it and why you love it.
If you like bird watching, and I'm not an expert birder, like I'm partially colorblind, so I'm never going to be a great birder. Yeah, I have an app that I use to help me identify what's around me by the sounds or the songs the birds are making. But at Trempealeau Refuge, you don't really need much of an app. There's a big area of wetlands with an easy view of the visitor center that attracts a lot of waterfowl, especially in the spring and fall. And I've seen beavers in some of the backwater habitats. There's a dike you can hike out along about half a mile or three quarters of a mile that passes through these wetland habitats where there's often a lot of mammals and other wildlife going on. I just find it a very peaceful place. You know, one of the unfortunate things about some of the parks along the Mississippi is that sometimes there are train tracks that run right next to them or through them. So sometimes the noise can get to be a lot. But at Trempealeau Refuge, the train tracks are far away. It's not next to the highway. So I think there's a quietness and a serenity to that place that a lot of other places don't have. And just so much, you know, so many birds to watch.
Jeff and Barry Mills, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Jeff.
Yes, I just wanted to bring up a book I read quite a few years back. I don't recall who the author was. I think the book was The History of the Mississippi River from the Beginning of Time. It talks about how most of North America was just a lake or something at the time, and I found it to be just fascinating.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't think of the author on that one. Dean, do you?
I'm not familiar with that book. No, I may have to look that up and see if I can find it. I did a fair amount of research on the geology of the Mississippi River and North America when I was writing that first chapter. So what I have in there is a really thumbnail sketch of that history. But it is really fascinating to get into the details of how the Mississippi developed and how it changed over time.
Jeff, thank you for calling. Prairie in Clyde, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Oh, hey, yeah, I was so excited to turn on the radio and hear you talking about the Mississippi. We, about 12 years ago, my partner and I did a bike trip, went down a good bit of it, at least between here and central Missouri. And we've kind of always had a daydream of loading the family up.
Oh, we lost him. We lost him. I bet he was thinking about loading the family up and taking them the whole length.
Yeah.
Are you back, Bray?
Yeah. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. We've had this daydream of doing like a houseboat or a longer term, you know, camping and river, you know, exploring it from the river. And I wonder if, you know, is that realistic? Do people still do that? Yeah, what do you think about that idea?
Yeah,
people do it. You know, there's a small community of people who do the Great Circle, you know, the route that basically goes through the Great Lakes down the Mississippi and the Intercoastal Waterway and then back up the East Coast and down the St. Lawrence River. They're certainly doing that. There are some people who do some longer term boat trips on the Mississippi. I think at this point, it's mostly paddlers who are doing those kinds of trips. That I hear about, but there may be others in houseboats or other kinds of boats. But it's also just an easy place to drive along. There are a lot of campgrounds along the river, some of them right next to the river, some of them big enough to accommodate big RVs, and others that might only be, you know, ideal for a tent. So there are lots of different ways to explore it.
Yeah, that Great River Road is I think probably if you're driving that's probably think about the Mississippi River, that's probably the best drive you're going to get on the Mississippi, at least in my mind. I don't know about you.
Oh, absolutely. It runs, I probably should have this memorized. I have another book that's just for the Great River Road, but it's something like 25 or 2700 miles on each side of the river. So you can drive down one side and turn around and come back up the other side, depending upon how much time you want to kill. Or I really hope, though, when people do this drive, that my goal is to help people slow down with these trips.
Yeah.
I think the beauty in the river comes from spending time and really watching and observing things and slowing down. I hope more people do that rather than trying to squeeze in 1,000 miles in 4 days or something.
Yeah. There's so many towns, places along, which you recount in your book.
Yeah. There are just all kinds of little beautiful river towns along the way. And there's always, you know, it seems like there's always a bar right next to the river that's got good burgers and fries and good views, so, and good stories. Usually some river rats hanging out in there that'll talk your ears off.
Yeah, the Kenny Solway almost talked my ear off more than one time. who wrote, and I think you mentioned him in the book, in your book, The Last River Rat. It was a great book.
Oh, I love that book. And it really had a big influence on me, too, because he just does such a great job of detailing how the life along the river changes across the seasons. I think it was a beautiful book.
Yeah. Tim in Madison, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Larry. Yeah, talking about narratives about the Mississippi River, as a history teacher and history buff, you know, reading some of those early narratives, you know, like from Father Marquette or Zebulon Pike or Henry Schoolcraft, you know, it's just gives a great opportunity to learn more about what the river was like, you know, decades and centuries ago. So I would recommend that to any history buffs that want to learn more about, you know, the history river, the Mississippi River that way.
Yeah, Tim, thank you so much for calling. Dean, you'd agree with that, I bet.
I would. There's a guy named Thomas, I'm going to butcher his name, Thomas Rice Smith, who has a book that he wrote kind of summarizing those early travel narratives along the Mississippi. I think those books are really interesting, and they continue to this day. People are still writing books about their experiences traveling along the Mississippi. So I think it's a great genre, and every one of those kind of gives you a slightly different perspective on the river and the river at different points in time.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite spot on the river?
Yeah. Boy, I'm still partial to La Crosse in a lot of ways. I know I'm not supposed to pick favorites as somebody who writes about the entire river and is trying to talk about the whole river. I lived in La Crosse for 6 years when I was in college, and I stuck around for a year after that. And I'm still so attached to that part of the river. I like the scenic beauty, the bluffs, and the ease of getting on the water there, and the fact that there's still those lush backwaters intact in a lot of places. I think it's just any place in that area, especially in the Driftless area, is high on my list.
Yeah, I would agree. I've been up there in the fall to do a little bird watching on the fall migration up through that area is fantastic.
Absolutely. And I will say, too, downplay this, but I really love the lower Mississippi as well. And I think more people should find ways to experience that and see the beauty in that as well. It's just that it's a little harder to access for most of us, because for some of it, you really kind of need a boat, whether it's a canoe or something with a motor. But you really need a boat and a chance to get out on the water and stay there for a little while to fully appreciate that, I think.
Yeah, I think you're probably right about that. We didn't mention much about Missouri, but what's your favorite spot in Missouri?
I love, one of the easiest places for me to get to is up at the confluence of the Missouri and Mississippi. There's a place called Columbia Bottom State Conservation Area, and I love hiking there. I've been up there a lot the last few years. So that's great, because sometimes the river gets low and the back channel dries out, and I can walk to an island, which is a fun experience. But second favorite, I love Trail of Tears State Park, where, for the reminder of the history, but also for the natural beauty in that particular area.
Yeah, that's got to be a really thoughtful place to visit and reflect.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, how's the book doing? Just out.
Well, I hope. It's been out a little over a week or a week. Yeah, I'm losing track of time. It was released on the 21st. So I've been very happy with the feedback I've gotten so far. I'm thrilled to have this book out. Like, I joke with folks, like, anytime a book comes out, I feel this mix of excitement and terror, because I'm never entirely sure what the reception's going to be. And I put a lot into this book. I really wanted this to be something that people would turn to and would help them see the river in a new way. So hopefully it's doing that.
I think it is, Dean, and I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. It's been a real pleasure talking with you and learning more about the Wild Mississippi. That's the title of Dean's book, by the way, The Wild Mississippi, A State-by-State Guide to the River's Natural Wonders. Been a pleasure talking with him, and a whole lot more coming up, so you stay with us. I'm Larry Mealy.